Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Nearly 3,500 square miles of wilderness comprise Yellowstone National Park, which became the world's first national park in 1872. At the time, many Americans viewed their nation's untamed wilderness areas as dangerous realms better tapped for resources. And even after the National Park Service was established in 1916, what our leaders intended for it would change with the times. Coming up, we'll hear from the author of a new history book celebrating the centennial of the National Park Service. Joining us now is director of a new 3D film about our national park system, two-time Academy Award-nominated director Greg McGilliver. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ann.
National Parks Adventures 3D is set to release in IMAX theaters, including COSI, this week. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about that and all the festivities. So, Greg, how did you decide where to film once you got this assignment?
Well, that's kind of a tough thing to do because there's so many beautiful parks. There's over 400 park sites, and I wanted to feature some of the lesser known places, partly because people haven't seen them before. But we also went to the iconic places like Yellowstone and Yosemite and the Grand Canyon. But we bring the audience to Devil's Tower up in Wyoming, which is just an incredibly beautiful place. To Acadia in Maine, and of course the Everglades down in Florida.
The film was shot in, is it 30 national parks over a 9-month period?
Well, actually, we had five teams, and so we were able to go to 40 parks. 30 are covered in some depth, and about 10 are covered quite deeply. You actually stay there for quite a while in the film.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm speaking with film director Greg McGillivray. He is the director of a new film. It will be released on February 12th, National Parks Adventure 3D. For more information, again, go to our website, the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. It's about our national park system, which is celebrating its centennial this year. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Also, listeners, I'm interested in knowing what your favorite national park is, or if you have a special memory of a national park that you want to share with us. Appreciate that. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said you had five teams. Were you on with every team, or how did that work? How did you decide the angles and the time of day?
Well, I wasn't with every one of the teams all the time. I instructed each one of the teams and directed them and I'd look at their footage when they'd send it back in. Two of the teams were time-lapse teams that would go to a site and stay there for 10 days and wait for the right conditions. And so in the film, you'll see things that you probably won't be able to see on your own. We get up really early in the morning. We get there, set up our cameras for sunrise. We get the beautiful sunrises and of course the great sunsets, and try to get those conditions that you rarely see. The national parks are perfect for that.
3D filming, everybody loves a good 3D film these days. We're getting pretty used to them, but how does that change what you do, if at all?
It does. You want to set the camera up so that you maximize your 3D and so it's comfortable for the audience as well.
Huh.
And you also move the camera so that the audience senses that they're actually standing or walking through the site that the camera is set in. And so it's a different kind of film directing to do a 3D movie. We, in fact, shot with the finest 3D camera ever built. It's a $1 million camera called the Solito. It's built by IMAX, and it's running two strips of 70-millimeter film, 3 minutes at a time. So each roll is 3 minutes. One roll for the right eye, one roll for the left eye. So there are two lenses, two cameras side by side as one. And the camera weighs 350 pounds, takes four big guys to carry it around.
Oh my God.
So it's really, but the result is an experience that you're not going to get anywhere else. It's just astounding.
You know, just watching it in two dimensions, I have to say, or I guess one dimension, I don't know, just watching it on the preview, there was one point where you, I think it was at the very beginning of the film, where you're climbing up, the people in the film are climbing up to the top of a peak, and then they're standing up there, and there's only like a couple feet. And I thought, yeah, I don't really want to watch it. I thought it was, yeah. That was just that way. I mean, it must be amazing in 3D.
Oh, it is. You know, you do get that sense of vertigo. And these climbers, we follow Conrad Anker, his son Max, and their friend Rachel Pohl around to the various parks as they're basically taking a road trip, climbing in each one of the parks, or mountain bike riding, or strolling, taking hikes. That's basically the story of the film. There's a parallel story with Teddy Roosevelt and John Muir back in 1903, when they decide that forming the National Park Service is a necessary thing. Teddy Roosevelt was president then, and he decided this is worth the struggle. Let's go fight those developers and make sure that we develop a National Park Service to preserve these areas, not for exploitation, not for money-making, but for the people forever. And that's the wonderful thing about the National Park Service, is it's here forever.
As far as, did you talk about what's been lost at all in the process of all of this? There's the downside of the National Park Service, people that were forced to leave their land and that sort of thing?
We talk about the reasons for the National Park Service and why national parks are so valuable to us.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Sequoia, in my state of California, 95% of the redwoods, these tallest trees on the planet, were cut down for lumber. Finally, the National Park Service set aside quite a big grove forever, so botanists and people can go and study and appreciate these massive trees. They only grow in California,
mm-hmm.
Nowhere else on the world. So you basically are saving things that are endangered elsewhere. And it's an amazing thing having these parks. And of course, we have them all through the country.
Exactly. And they're not just at natural areas. They're also at monuments and that sort of thing. How did that play into the story you told?
We did film at several monuments. You know, I tried to sprinkle the sites around the nation. We have several shots in Hawaii and Alaska, and then, as I said, the corners of America, as well as the interior. One of the coolest places that we went to, and we didn't know it was going to be so great, was in Michigan. Upper Michigan has a place called Pictured Rocks National Seashore, and in the middle of the winter, they have these cascading waterfalls that are far bigger than Niagara that freeze up, and they just are magical. I've never seen anything that beautiful in my life. I mean, it's just stunning. And you'll see that in the movie.
Yeah, I just went kayaking up there in the fall. So you showed the Pictured Rocks in the winter or in other parts of the season, other seasons?
In the winter, yeah.
And
we were fortunate last year. They had a cold snap right before we got there, so Lake Superior froze over, so we were able to get to some of these remote waterfall locations on snowmobiles, so we could carry all of our heavy equipment. We had 30 loads of equipment that had to be carried out there every morning at 4 or 5 a.m. And then brought back at dusk. It was like a military operation, but it was minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit. So I got snow frostbite on my feet, and they were numb for 4 months.
Wow.
Some of the climbers got frostbite. It was really a struggle, but it was worth it because the filming was just fantastic.
How did you get some of the aerial shots? It looks like drones.
Well, we used a drone for two shots in the movie. Okay. The rest of the aerials are done with the best helicopter and the best helicopter pilot and cameraman in the world. A guy named Ron Goodman from California. He does all the important big feature films, you know, for the studios.
Mm-hmm.
And he works for me. Occasionally, you know, we take him to these exotic places, and he gets some of the most amazing shots that people ever see. And he uses a big helicopter mount with an IMAX camera inside that mount, and the mount gyro-stabilizes the camera so that it has no vibration or no shake whatsoever. So when you sit really close to the screen, as you do in an IMAX theater, you don't get any nausea. You don't feel disoriented in any way. It feels like a magic carpet ride. It's just a beautiful experience.
Tell us about some other sites besides Pictured Rocks that you've seen that surprised you or you hadn't seen before and learned.
Well, I was at Bryce Canyon 40 years ago shooting for our film To Fly for the Air and Space Museum in Washington. And I was stunned by its beauty then. But since that time, Bryce Canyon has become even better. The National Park Service has built new paths. In fact, one path called Fairyland, you can walk on for probably about 6 to 8 hours. Some of the times you'll not even see another person for an hour or so. You're so far away from the parking lot area. And it's just a stunning, stunning place. And so that's now my favorite of all the national parks. That's in Utah, mm-hmm. Bryce. The other places that are pretty interesting, you know, are like the Carlsbad Caverns. We have one shot of caverns in the United States. Monument Valley, of course, which is just such an iconic place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people come from the world over to see these places because nowhere else are these landforms found. These places are so special. And it was kind of, you know, amazing 100 years ago that these places got set aside forever because it was always a struggle. Congress, for a long time, didn't want to pass judgment on these places because these people in those regions wanted to exploit them, wanted to make them into tourist destinations or build houses or hotels there. In fact, when Teddy Roosevelt went to the edge of the Grand Canyon and looked over for the first time, he might have been actually the first president to see the Grand Canyon. And he said, you should not touch this. You'll only mar it. Leave it as it is today. And the people of Arizona didn't want to make it a national park. They wanted to exploit it. Of course, now they love the fact that it's a national park and it's one of the most well-attended tourist destinations anywhere. And they call themselves the Grand Canyon State now.
Mm-hmm.
And so times change. Now, of course, we are so appreciative that we have these places of solace and reflection, places where you can actually hear yourself think and get away from a cell phone and other people. It's such a special thing, and I'm so happy that we were able to make this movie.
Well, Greg McGillivray, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. Really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for the questions. I appreciate it.
Greg McGillivray, he is the director of a new 3D film about our national park system and a two-time Academy Award nominee. You can see the film at COSI. For more information about that, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. The name of the movie is entitled National Parks Adventures 3D. More about our centennial for the national parks when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 100 years ago, U.S. President Woodrow Wilson signed into law the creation of the National Park Service. The service immediately was entrusted to oversee some 35 sites, but its job has expanded over time to more than 400 sites across the nation. And how its job has been interpreted has changed as well. We just heard from the director of a new IMAX film to celebrate the centennial. It opens February 12th at COSI. For more information, check out the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now by phone from Colorado is Heather Hansen, author of Prophets and Moguls, Rangers and Rogues, Bison and Bear, 100 Years of the National Park Service. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Thanks so much, Anna. It's a pleasure.
And also, listeners, give us your favorite national park. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us what your favorite national park is, and we'd love to hear why. Heather, we often hear about the work of Theodore Roosevelt when it comes to establishing the National Park Service, but that isn't exactly right. Where's the confusion? What was his role?
Well, the Park Service actually started, as you said, 100 years ago, and it I think it has a longer history than people really recognize. And that's, one of the things that's so exciting about this year is kind of going back to that origin story and sorting all that out. You know, we had in the beginning this millionaire ad executive with this megawatt smile that, you know, charmed everybody in his path, you know, partnered with this shy, intelligent law student from California. And somehow they came together in this partnership, you know, at least started this service and this park system that really became the envy of the world.
What inspired Roosevelt?
He spent a lot of time out west, you know, particularly in the Dakotas. We celebrate him in the Badlands in particular now. And I think it was that sense of open space and that democratic ideal. You know, you look even nowadays around the world, and a lot of the open spaces or so-called open spaces that we have are actually private holdings. You know, and something we have that's so special here is that, you know, people had the foresight, including Roosevelt, you know, in his part, in reserving a lot of those places for the public domain. And that's entirely unique in the world.
Now, he did sign into law the Antiquities Act of 1906, which sort of got the ball rolling.
It did, absolutely. And today that's reflected so clearly in the diversity of the park system, because we have, cultural sites and historical sites that, you know, could have easily been plundered, you know, as they were during Roosevelt's time, you know, and people got his attention and let him know that, these places were going to be lost, were going to be destroyed without some machinery to protect them.
You wrote about photographer John Muir and naturalist John Burroughs. What were their contributions?
People know John Muir very well, but I think, history has lost John Burroughs a bit. You know, and there was a time over 100 years ago now where naturalist writers were actually, you know, very popular and in the mainstream. And he was somebody who, you know, bent the ear of presidents and, you know, other naturalists that were maybe better known, you know, Emerson and Muir. And they really, you know, followed his lead when he, you know, near the Hudson River in New York saw all these factories coming up and all this degradation. And he sort of retreated and said, you know, if we can find these simple things and appreciate them, that's really the crux of life. And ordinary Americans and, you know, people with influence, they listened, and he really played a key part in getting that ball rolling.
All of this amid the Industrial Revolution, though, it wasn't without its detractors.
Absolutely not. You know, and the genesis of the Park Service itself, still has a lot of that as well. You know, at 1916, you know, people were interested in getting what they could, you know, exploitation and moving west and, you know, conquering all the natural elements they could with, dams and farms and ranches and, you know, a lot of amazing things, but a lot of things that did damage as well.
What the powers that be considered the mission of the Park Service changed over time. What were the, so once there's a Park Service established, then how did it change over time?
So initially it was, as listeners probably know, pretty focused on natural areas, Yellowstone and Yosemite and some of the better known parks out west here. But over time that the Eastern influence came in, not just in terms of natural parks, Acadia and the Great Smokies and Shenandoah and some of those pieces, which were very difficult to put together because of all the private holdings, but they managed to do that. But also in the 30s, the Park Service gained all of these historical parks, and that had a lot to do with the second director of the Park Service, Horace Albright, who is quite a history buff, and he campaigned for many, many years to be able to tell Americans that story. He felt that history was a really important part of the job that the Park Service had to do. So we gained a lot of historical and Civil War parks, monuments, and that's how the Park Service has grown into a system and a service that has over 400 units now, very diverse.
People wait in long lines sometimes to see parts, especially of Yellowstone and Yosemite. But a different sort of patience was needed to see those places back in the day. You wrote about about that trajectory. The railroads helped to change that somewhat.
They did. Yeah, it's funny when I spent about a year on the road writing this book, and I definitely did my fair share of grumbling about the time it took to drive somewhere remote, or like you said, waiting on a line at a popular month at a popular park, Yosemite, for example. But it used to be much, much harder, and days and weeks of stagecoaches and eating a lot of dust. And I tell a lot of these stories in Prophets and Moguls, really, really fun stuff. But yes, the railroads did eventually come in and play a really big part, not just in helping people access parks, but really in advocating for the creation of several parks, probably the most prominent of them, Glacier National Park, which really has its history rooted in the railroads and some of the fascinating personalities and advocates and some of the other stories I tell in the book.
Yeah, well, how did Glacier stand apart? What was the significance of the railroads in that story?
Well, they were the railroads were stretching west, to create a transcontinental system, and the people there who were interested in, creating the whistle stops and charging, then, which was mostly wealthy tourists enough to come out there. They really knew that it was a money making venture, so they wanted to create stops near parks and create parks as things for people to spend money to get to. So it was kind of a great blend of conservation and capitalism all rolled into one.
Listeners, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And once again, I ask, if you have a favorite national park, now's the time. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It's fun to talk about, national parks, where you've been and what you've seen. They inspire different people in different ways. So, give us a call and share your story. I want to, joining us now is Rick Perkins. He's Chief Ranger for Hopewell Culture National Historical Park and the Dayton Aviation Heritage National Historic Park. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate being on board. Anytime I can talk about the Park Service, this is a good thing.
How is your mission different from, say, the head ranger at Yosemite?
Essentially, it's the same title and the same functions, but a much smaller park here in Ohio in regards to what goes on at Yosemite or one of the Yellowstone parks. A lot more search and rescue goes on there versus the smaller parks like here. And again, I've worked at a number of different other parks, Glacier Bay in Alaska and Isle Royale, so I'm used to those type of functions. But the bureaucracy is a little bit different, too, here in Ohio, where we don't have a lot of the political pressures that might be hitting one of the smaller historical sites like you would get out there.
Hmm. And when you decide to go into the National Park Service as a career, you go in knowing full well you could wind up you know, anywhere?
Well, not necessarily. Okay. And we get to apply for any job that we want to go to. It's a, okay. It's a government service, but it's not military service. So if I chose a park to go to, I would go through the same process as anybody else, and I'd fill out the applications. It certainly comes it comes along with your skills that would fit you right to the right site, but it really comes from you filling out an application and going.
Volunteers form a big part of the National Park Service.
Yeah, 221 million volunteers, I think, was this last year was registered with the National Park Service. And between me and a couple of our staff, we help coordinate the volunteer program that we have right here in Ohio.
Yeah, Heather?
I'm here.
Yeah. Did you, as far as working with the Park Service and you know, covering the territory as it was in your book, how did you coordinate with them? What were the goals?
Hi, Rick. I just wanted to say hello first. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Hey, thank you.
I as I said, covered many miles, I think 20,000 plus. And I, you know, started at my hometown park here. Rocky Mountain National Park is just around the corner from me. And that's really where the genesis of the book, Prophets and Moguls, came out of. And I was a national park kid. You know, I spent summers in Cape Cod National Seashore. And, you know, I've always been a park kid. I probably mm-hmm. still am. And as I started to write about and do the reporting for this book, I just started contacting, you know, different rangers like Rick, you know, and telling them that I want to do a reflection on 100 years of the Park Service and really celebrate the work that they do, not just as a service, but really the story of the Park Service is the story of national parks in this country, and it's really the story of the conservation idea. You can't have one without the other. So people pretty quickly got on board and wanted to help me celebrate that.
It's easy to take for granted the National Park Service and the parks. I grew up backpacking on Isle Royale and really didn't understand the significance of the fact that this entire island was made a national park, and which made it affordable and easy to get to and easy to be on. Rick, what about your experience with the parks that you oversee now in Ohio? The Hopewell Culture National Historical Park, in particular, has several sites. What's it like to manage something that's not necessarily on everybody's radar, but extremely important?
Yeah, it's a different whole story when you're looking at a park that's smaller like Hopewell Culture, that it's a destination site for people with specific interest, which is archaeology or indigenous Native American history. So it's a different whole story, people coming to there versus Isle Royale. Like I said, I worked there for 4 years, and those were backpackers. It was an easier audience because you're dealing with all backpackers or boaters. So it adds a different dimension in regards to when people get there is trying to teach them what the site is all about. It's easy to go to Yellowstone because people have heard of Yellowstone for over 100 years. So it's a different whole story.
And it's what you see. But with Hopewell, it's a lot of what you don't see.
Yeah, Hopewell's kind of hidden in regards to what it has. And that's our job right now is to try to bring the Native American life back to Ohio, which is somewhat missing because we don't see it here on an everyday process, which is why Hopewell is on the World Heritage list right now, on the very short list. So we might have a World Heritage destination here in the next 2 to 3 years, we hope.
We have an email from Bob in Westerville, and Heather, I'm interested in your thoughts, and Rick Perkins as well. He writes, the Ken Burns film on national parks was so self-congratulatory and so complimentary in regard to preserving those parks that he forgot that the First Nation peoples had sustained all those lands for thousands of years. This was long before Roosevelt looked into the Grand Canyon and otherwise got the ball rolling. Heather Hansen, thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think Rick will have interesting insights on this as well, but I have a chapter in the book that is based on a quote by Henry David Thoreau, which is civilized off the face of the earth, and that really comes, you know, face-to-face with the reality that, you know, when people looked out west, most people thought, you know, wide-open spaces, unpopulated, you know, nothing to do but whatever we want. And the truth of the matter was that in many places, including many parks, which I talk about in the book, in Glacier and in Yosemite and Yellowstone, they had very deep, you know, histories with different bands of American Indians. And, you know, that's a story I think the Park Service is beginning to resurface over time, you know, along with the other narratives that have not been, you know, as well told, you know, because we've told stories generally from a certain perspective historically. And now the Park Service has taken time, certainly over the past couple of decades, in telling those stories in a different way and inviting those partners to the table and having them tell their own stories, which is really a critical part of that.
Right, Rick Perkins, that's something, as you mentioned, is underway in Ohio.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I think throughout the entire country with all the 409 national parks, there's almost always some kind of Native American connection to each one of those. And here in Ohio, like I said, we've had this site for, you know, since the 1930s, and we're just now starting to get people to understand that it truly is a Native American site. And I think we failed to do that partly. And I was just reading a book that my daughter brought home from school the other day, and it was an 80-page book on the history of Ohio, and the first two pages were on the Native American history in Ohio, and the rest was on everything else. So right. I see that as an issue that we're trying to correct.
Well, the Native American history in Ohio was so truncated because they were all forced out.
Exactly.
And then conversely, Hopewell dates back how far?
2,000 years. Yeah.
Right. So there's a big gap in there. we will continue our conversation. First, I want to read an email from Josh. He writes, I was raised in Columbus and live here now. But when I was 20, I lived and worked just outside of Smoky Mountain National Park in Gatlinburg. It was my first time living out of Ohio on my own, and exploring and hiking there was a great and formative experience. I go back to visit, and it brings back so many memories. So that's from Josh. Sounds like the Smoky Mountain National Park in Gatlinburg is his favorite national park. What is yours? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. 2016 is the centennial of the National Park Service, a tradition that many Americans take for granted. But wilderness and historical site protection hasn't been easy, even with the National Park Service behind it. We're talking about the history of that service and the properties it protects and oversees today. Still with us by phone from Colorado is Heather Hansen. She's author of Prophets and Moguls, Rangers and Rogues, Bison and Bears, 100 Years of the National Park Service. Heather, thanks again for joining us today.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you, Ann.
And also with me in the studio, Rick Perkins. He's Chief Ranger for Hopewell Culture National Historical Park and the Dayton Aviation Heritage National Historic Park. We'd like to hear from our listeners. What's your favorite national park? 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Heather, you wrote that between Yellowstone's founding in 1872 and the creation of the National Park Service in 1916, it was kind of an lawless period, I think is the way you put it, in all the national parks. What was going on?
There was a lot of effort to be exploiting these resources still during that time. And there were, the national park idea was not something that a whole lot of people understood or respected or encouraged in any way. So there were people who were, wanting to set up shop in pretty much every place other people wanted to protect. So there was a lot of, hunting and poaching, and, there are some incredible stories in the book about, different characters over time who had to be dissuaded from that kind of activity time and again. But it was definitely a period that rallied people around the idea of conservation, and that led to some important federal legislation to accompany the National Park Service Act, the Organic Act of 1960.
To give it some teeth.
Exactly. Yeah.
Rick Perkins, now I'm going to call you Rich. Rick Perkins, at Hopewell and at the Dayton Aviation Park, poaching and exploiting the resources isn't necessarily an issue, but did you have issues with that at other parks where you've worked?
Yeah, when I worked at Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska, it was people were constantly putting pressures on the park, and mostly what at that park that I did a lot of stuff for was the Marine Mammal Protection Act. People trying to run their boats right up on top of whales, and did a lot of marine
really,
mammal type
purpose?
Of protection on purpose. Yeah, trying to get their photo op. That was before cell phones, and or you could do your close up shot. But people were constantly getting up there. I had even had kayakers. Would try to grab on to the fins and so forth of some of the whales. And so that was the biggest thing that we did there. It's a large area. It's 600,000 acres of marine waters, so people could get lost pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. But we'd concentrate our areas in the whale area, and we'd find people constantly doing that. So,
Interesting. Brad in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Brad.
Oh, hello. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
The one of my favorite Navajo sayings is part of the saying is beauty above me, beauty below me, and beauty all around me. And there's even though I've been to most of the national parks in the lower 48, there's no place that I love better than Glacier Waterton International Peace Park. It's just so beautiful there. And I hear rangers and in other programs, and I witness it myself that. I hear the saying also that we may be loving our parks to death, and that sort of speaks to the ranger's last comment. I have found that to have the lightest impact on the parks, personally, I like to get on the trails and get out farther and farther. The farther I go, the less people I see, to the point where you see no people. Mm-hmm. And then you can get the true 3D experience. And it's just fantastic in Glacier. I live in Columbus. I've been to Glacier 20 out of the last 25 years.
Wow.
And I always drive. So I love going from here to there, seeing the way the country, the way the topography changes. But Glacier is special.
All right.
As far as an experience I've had there, there's one favorite place there that I love to go down by Lake St. Mary's. And I've probably been down there 20 times, just sitting on the rocks, looking at the beach, looking at Wild Goose Island. And one day, and it just happened to be the day I didn't take my bear spray with me, a grizzly bear pops out, walks onto the beach about 150 feet away from me, and I don't think I've ever moved so fast in all my life.
Oh, boy.
Quietly. Well,
exactly. Brad, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, the crowds, loving them to death. Heather Hansen, has that been an issue?
There are definitely parks that are mega popular, you know, and I'm sure Rick can talk to this as well, and they have, you know, months that are particularly popular as well. So you look at Yosemite, for example, is a very popular park, and you'll have people coming June, July, August, and, you know, not a whole lot of people the other months. So, you know, when people ask me, you know, any tips for visiting parks, you know, what types of experiences did I have over the year that I was on the road? And I always encourage people to go a shoulder season, you know, or off season if they can, because there are incredible things to be seen in Yosemite. You know, the waterfalls are alive in the spring, and a lot of people miss them in a year of drought. You know, they're not as spectacular, you know, and things quiet down, as your caller was saying, you know, at different times of the year when you get off trail. So I encourage people to get out, you know, as much as they're capable of doing that and away from the crowds. So, sorry.
No, go ahead.
So there are definitely aspects of parks being loved to death, but part of it, I think, is that the Park Service needs a little bit more support, you know, from Congress. They are, you know, struggling with their budget, and they just announced recently, you know, a $12 billion backlog in maintenance, and that's, you know, critical infrastructure that's not being taken care of, and so people are, you know, maybe starting to see signs of that wear and tear, and, you know, that's when we come in. That's when, you know, every American that supports parks can do something.
Rick Perkins?
Yeah, thank you. I certainly feel for what the caller had to say there, but why I love the idea that the national parks are being loved to death. I like seeing more and more people get out there to visit them. You know, I took my daughters to Yellowstone and Tetons this last summer, and we certainly hit the Old Faithful and some of the key points as you hit those national parks, but we also went to the areas that are off-road, just like the caller said, and found our own time where we could enjoy ourselves in a beautiful area. So it is happening, but I don't think it's as bad as what it is. And, you know, for from the big environmental movement of the 70s, the National Park Service certainly jumped on board with having everybody coming to the parks. But we lost about a generation, maybe two generations, thinking that that we were going to continue to have people always come like we did from the 70s and the 60s. And they went to more of the phones and more of the games and all that kind of stuff. So I'm really tickled that the Park Service has realized that and moving back forward and promoting parks with Ticket to Ride grants and the Centennial programs that are going on now. So I think we're seeing a change in what we do. It's just a matter of getting the folks that we miss for those generation or so to come back. The kids are the ones that are actually starting to ones that bring the parents back that we miss. So I'm tickled to see that happening too.
I was glad to see when I visited the Pearl Harbor National Park, the memorial monument, that there were lots of signs around very prominently where this is a place of respect. This is a like a cemetery, and you have to show respect. And people really responded to that. I was a little worried on our way out there that it was going to be different, that people were going to be, you know, chatting it up like they do at, you know, Old Faithful. But it was very respected.
Yeah, you know, when we were at Old Faithful, I found it to be kind of surreal where everybody was quiet. There was probably 2,000 people sitting around on the bleachers waiting for it to go. And once it did, there was the clap and the roar, which you would expect for something fabulous like that. So I found that to be good, and everybody was respectful. Yeah, we, as a ranger, it was hard to not like a ranger there when people were getting too close to bison and just keep on driving. But at the same time, most of the people were there and they're not damaging the resources. It's a small percentage that might do that.
There was something interesting that happened. Well, I'm going to get to that. I want to get to Rich first in Whitehall. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi, Ann. Pleasure to be with you.
You bet.
I wanted to put a plug in for my favorite national park, which is Death Valley National Park. I'm an avid hiker. I hike all over the country, and many of the places are national parks. But Death Valley is my favorite because it's absolutely unique. It's a place where there's not a lot of cover. There's not a lot of dirt. It's all geologic formations, salt pans, wonderful vistas, and I love it. I go out there, and I guide hikes, and it's a lot of fun, and it's really beautiful. It's the hottest place on Earth and the lowest place in the hemisphere. So it's a place of extremes, but it's wonderful.
Thank you, Rich, for your call. I appreciate it.
Right.
We have a few minutes left. If you want to give us a call and tell us your favorite national park, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The use of predicides, now that word is in quotation marks in your book, Heather Hansen, but anyways, the use of predicides on public lands was banned by executive order in 1972 by Richard Nixon. What was that about?
That was a response to the effort in parks up to that point to basically control the visitor experience. You know, there were animals in parks that were seen as good animals, and those were mostly game animals, you know, and people wanted to see huge herds of elk and deer and to some extent bison, although they were largely on the decline by then. But wolves and coyotes were seen as bad and other predatory animals. And it took many years of backlash against that policy and the dawning of the scientific knowledge that these creatures were all part of the larger ecosystem and really key to them functioning well for that to change. So as Rick was talking about, you know, that movement in the 70s, really that was part of that larger recognition that we had to put things back as well as we could to the way they were, and that included predators.
Isle Royale is a great example of how they reintroduced wolves to Isle Royale. They'd been eliminated. Or almost.
Yeah, actually, the wolves actually came over across on ice. So,
right.
But it's a great predator-prey study, and it's been the longest ongoing predator-prey study for 40-some years now. And I didn't track what happened for this last year's winter study. It's going on right now, so I know that's continuing. So,
and, of course, the prey would be the moose.
The moose, yeah.
Right, which, frankly, posed more danger to me. You never saw a wolf, but the moose could get angry too.
Right.
Email from Paul in Mount Sterling. We've been fortunate to have visited many national parks, so it's tough to choose a favorite. The majesty of Denali and its sheer scale. The colors of Polychrome Point are unbelievably beautiful. It's the only place I've ever seen a full double rainbow, while grizzly, doll sheep, moose, and caribou abound. Wow. Email from Luke. I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to visit a great many national parks in a very short period of time between my freshman and sophomore year of high school. It was not something I wanted to do at the time, but my parents made me. It turned out to be one of the best experiences I've ever had. The program was run through my school. 30 kids piled into an old school bus and hit the road, stopping at a different national park every few days. Glacier was by far my favorite, and Yellowstone was my least favorite. It smells and is extremely crowded. The trip gave me a much greater appreciation of the country I live in. It sounds like the Worthington Field Studies group that he's describing.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, great. You were lucky, Luke. Charlene in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlene.
Hi. I like all the parks. The national parks are my favorites. I like the diversity of all the parks. I've been in all 50 states. But I have to say that Yellowstone is probably my favorite, and Yosemite and Glacier.
Mm-hmm.
I like the many wild animals and the geysers and the campground and the mountains of the Tetons going into Yellowstone. That's probably what makes Yellowstone my favorite.
Well, thanks, Charlene, for sharing that. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care. Boy, she's well-traveled, huh? another issue you bring up, Heather Hansen, that hadn't occurred to me until I read your book is parkitecture. Another coined term, parkitecture. It's been an issue. What were they shooting for in the beginning, and what have we wound up with?
Well, in the beginning, they were, you know, interested in quality, you know, in building things that suited their environment, but were also, you know, a centerpiece, you know, for people. I mentioned the wealthier people who would travel by train, you know, really a place that would suit those people away from home. And about 50 years ago, we had another resurgence, you know, in architecture with a major influx of cash from Congress, something that hasn't happened at this benchmark, at least yet. And a lot of the architecture was kind of streamlined at that point. You know, so a lot of the visitor centers that we see now, you know, are a little bit more in that tradition, somewhat more generic, but still built to kind of suit their environment.
And tell a story, right, Rick Perkins?
Yeah, that's Mission 66 type of construction. And a good example of that is that Hopewell Culture, when it was built, the first visitor center was built at that site, it was built to look like the southwestern United States type of Indian type of thing. So flat roof and nothing close to what would be in this area. So,
right.
So yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I lived in a lot of those early houses working for the Park Service because I was a required occupant at Glacier Bay as well as Isle Royale. So I lived in a lot of those old Mission 66 homes. Some of them were still there today.
Email from Beth. My favorite is Kings Canyon and the Avenue of the Giants. It was my first road trip alone to the national parks. My parents took me to many of the national parks. I love Carlsbad Caves at sunset. Breathtaking. Thanks to you, Beth, and everybody else. If we get some extra emails, I think we do. We'll try to post them on our Facebook page today. Rick Perkins, I know there's a special event at COSAI on Friday, so we're running out of time now, but I'm going to direct people to go to the link on our website at WOSU.org. Rick Perkins will be there. He's Chief Ranger for Hopewell Culture National Historical Park and Dayton Aviation Heritage National Historic Park. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
Yeah, thank you.
And also Heather Hansen, author of Prophets and Moguls, Rangers and Rogues, Bison and Bears, 100 Years of the National Park Service. Thanks to you.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to talk about parks with you.
It sure is a lot of fun. I agree.
It is.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.